Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here tonight. I hope to catch up to the New Testament. We'll see what happens. First of all, I'm going to flash through this real quickly, maybe just see if I can do this correctly here. Some of this will be familiar, but just so you can kind of see, this is the high priest. And we can go way back to Joshua in 521 to 490 B.C., Jehoiakim, Eliashib, Jehoiada, Jonathan, Jadua, he's the one who met Alexander the Great, Onias, he's prophesied in the book of Daniel, Simeon the First, going all the way down here, you can see these guys coming down. You may remember Jason, the one who bought the priesthood. We got Onias, these guys here, that was a good high priest. Jason bought the priesthood from Antiochus Epiphanes. Now you're in the 175, 172 B.C., we're pushing the Maccabean revolt right here. So this is just that list of names of high priests. Then you go to this chart. There you go. Then Jason sent up to Antiochus Epiphanes the tribute to keep the priesthood. He sent Menelaus with it. And when Menelaus got there, he goes, hey, I'll give you twice as much for the priesthood. He gave him a division of soldiers and sent him back. Now he's the high priest from the tribe of Benjamin. And then right in here, Elchemus. And then we're not sure what takes place right here, but that's when then the Maccabean revolt breaks out. And then the first high priest, we got the Mattathias, the old man out in the hill country, his five sons, Judas and Jonathan and Simeon, they have the revolt. Then by 153, one of the boys' names, Jonathan, there's two brothers left, Jonathan Maccabeus and Simeon Maccabeus. That's where we begin right here, Simeon or Simon. He's the first of the five brothers to become the high priest, kind of unites the governorship or the kingship with the priesthood and is also in charge of the military. When he dies, his son Simeon or Simon becomes the high priest and is also the governor and the general. And then we continue down. We're going to talk about these guys here, John Hyrcanus. And we mentioned these guys last week, Aristobulus, Alexander Janaeus. It's kind of where we left off. We'll review this. Then John Hyrcanus the second. Aristobulus, John Hyrcanus, again, is restored. These guys are fighting civil wars back and forth. Antigonus, Aristobulus, these are just names. I just want to read through these names. These are all guys that we know from history and some details about. And this continues now. Anileus, we'll mention these guys. Then when I would get into 30 B.C., Joshua, Ben-Phabas, Simon, Ben, and again, you can see these names right here. Simon, whatever they go, Eleazar, Joshua. This should be familiar. There you go. That's the godfather of the New Testament. He was around when Jesus was on trial. And his son, he was removed as high priest by the Romans. He was high priest from 6 A.D. to 15 A.D. and was removed by the Romans because he was just too much of a political player. So he was removed. You know what I'm talking about. He's the godfather that shows up at the trial. And they call him the high priest, but he wasn't the high priest. Some of the Gospels refer to him as the high priest because he was, in a sense, the rightful high priest. But the Romans pulled him out of the position, put him in retirement. But then his son was high priest. Another son of his was high priest. Another son was high priest until they ended. And then Joseph Caiaphas, and you know Caiaphas in the New Testament, he married Annas' daughter. So this was his son-in-law. So when Jesus was put on trial, Joseph Caiaphas was the high priest, but he was the son-in-law of the former retired high priest and was serving after three other sons had served and then had been removed or passed away and he was in the position. So when Jesus goes to the high priest, this is the acting high priest, he also goes away and meets with another high priest, and this is where he's not the high priest, but he's in the background. That's why I call him the godfather. He was controlling everything. He was not the official high priest, but was acting through Joseph Caiaphas. And now you're into the end of the New Testament. The New Testament takes place right through these times right here. Just kind of see how that all kind of leads up. We got all those names. Yes, ma'am. I don't know. I'd have to look. But we would have gone by it already. You can copy it down real quick. No, you can actually take a picture. But you can actually Google it too. I mean, this is not like you know, rocket science that, you know, I found in a cave while I was in Israel, so no one else knows. I mean, it's fairly common, and you get more details about it. I'd have to check and see if it's in the book. I'm not sure. Okay. But anyway, that's just kind of neat how that goes from, again, talking about what's neat is the consistency. Joshua was the high priest that came back and was serving at the end of the Old Testament in Nehemiah's day, Zechariah's day, and it goes all the way up to the high priest. I see how corrupted he came. Now, this Joseph Caiaphas, a few years ago, I think it was south of Jerusalem. I can't tell exactly where it was. I haven't seen it myself. But they were doing some landscaping. It was outside of Jerusalem, close to the ancient city. They're doing some kind of work with some trees or forest work or something. And they had a bulldozer that was moving some dirt. And it fell into the ground, just caved in. And it fell in on the high priest's tomb with a ossuary of Joseph Caiaphas, and had all of these people I mentioned had all their ossuaries with their bone boxes. So we have the bones of Joseph Caiaphas and the very ornate. Some of the ossuaries are just stone boxes, just really plain, where they just put the bones in. It's very simple. His was very ornate, very clearly. His son was there, and the whole family was there. So that has been discovered. And you can Google that, too. Joseph Caiaphas' burial tomb. It gives you the whole story. I told you what I remember off the top of my head. You can get more details about that. So that's kind of neat. And it's not, you can say, well, are you sure? It's like, well, yeah, you can argue about anything you want to, but they have found Caiaphas. So it's interesting. The person who condemned Jesus, we have his sarcophagus or his ossuary and the bones and the DNA if you wanted to. Anyway, that's where we're at there. I'm going to ask you to open your framework books up to, let's say page 166. 160. Yeah, page 165. I'll pray and we'll get started. And like I said, I want to get up to where we begin, get ready to start the New Testament with the four Gospels, and this will be our last time in this history. Again, it's kind of interesting. It kind of really sets the flavor, the tension, to see that Jesus, when you see all the things that are taking place, Jesus walks into this mess and introduce himself as the Messiah with signs and wonders, and the crowds are following him. He has no weapons, no swords, and you can just see this whole chaos of just people killing each other and the crucifixions of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Herod's coming into the picture. The Romans are ruling, and it's just been a bloodbath for 300 years. And Jesus is going to walk into the midst of it. And the chance of him coming through that alive and claiming to be who he is and doing the things he says or that he does, and then having the crowds following. Imagine, as we read through this, we know about Palm Sunday. We know Palm Sunday. We celebrate it. We think about it. We talk about it. We preach about it. But when you think about Palm Sunday, with all of this crazy political warfare and civil war going on, and then Jesus comes riding in on a donkey with the crowds of people just cheering for him, and it's like it really disturbed these people. And there's not a chance. I mean, again, I'm making a statement. There's not a chance in the world that this political climate with the Romans, with the Herodians being in power, with the priesthood having fought and slaughtered themselves, the Jews back and forth for several centuries, are going to allow Jesus just to walk in and say, I'll take over, I'm the Messiah now. There's no one going to lay down. Romans aren't going to lay down. The Herodians aren't going to lay down. The priests are not going to lay down. They've been killing Jews for centuries, each other. And so when Jesus walks in, when he tells Peter, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and I'm going to be handed over to the Gentiles. Well, I mean, I believe that's prophecy. I believe that's divine insight. Jesus was telling him what was going to take place. But it really wasn't that brilliant of an idea. It's like, that's exactly, you're going to walk in there and claim to be the Messiah, have the crowd support you. Of course you're going to get crucified. Anyone's going to get crucified that comes into this situation. The disciples, including probably Judas, was probably hoping Jesus was going to, do something to upset this system, like, walk on water, turn the water to wine, do some kind of miracle, start glowing like a light bulb, do something that would stop all this. Instead, the Son of Man is going to go to Jerusalem, and he's going to be betrayed and handed over to the Gentiles. And Peter says, no, we can do better than that. We've seen what you can do. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. And then he walked into this mess. And of course, what's going to happen to Jesus? he's going to get killed. There's no doubt about it. And so that's kind of why this is important. Kind of, at least you get to hear it from this position. And like I say, there's so much history. We go back, we talk about the times of David, the times of Hezekiah. There's bits and pieces of history we've got that we can put together and bring in contemporary events from the Arameans or the Edomites or the Babylonians. But by the time we get to this group right here, there is tremendous amounts of history that has been recorded. We got conversations, and that's why it becomes even... I've got to teach through it and move on, because you could spend years talking about this kind of information. So, I guess I'm going to pray, and we'll get started. Father, we do come tonight to you, and thank you for the opportunity to look into your truth that's recorded in history, how you prepared the world for your Son, how you prepared our salvation through your Son. And Father, we do ask that we would continue to honor your truth, honor your revelation given to us through the Word of God, that we would again be able to analyze our own situations in this world that we live in today according to, again, your reality and your truth. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Page 165, a little bit of review. We're going to catch up with this fifth or the last of the Maccabean sons, Simon, and his family. We've talked about some of these guys here as they come down through. But here we go. 160. Judas Maccabeus is in battle and gets killed. And the solutions, they give the people a chance to mourn his death. And he has two brothers remaining. That's Simon and Jonathan. In 150, Jonathan is given the position of the high priest by the Seleucid king. Remember, the Seleucids are kind of the northern Syrians, are giving the Jews permission who's going to be the king. And Jonathan, Simon's brother, becomes the king. Jonathan is killed in 143. And Simon, the last of the five Maccabees, becomes the ruler of Judea. Judah is an independent nation with Simon, meaning they stand alone. They can make a treaty with Rome. They have respect from the Syrians as an independent nation. He serves as, this Simon serves, as you see right there, high priest, general, and king. And again, you just almost hear disaster coming when you put all three of those positions in one man. And everybody's following him. Too much power. He rules 8 years as the first Hasmonean. Again, the Maccabean family is from an ancestor named Asmonean or Asmoneus. And so that they become known as the Hasmoneans. That's how we translate the Hasmoneans. It's the priestly family. The descendants of the Maccabees call Hasmonean rule. They rule until 67 B.C., when Rome is going to annex it into the Roman Empire. And that they'll lose their independence in 67 B.C. We're in 142, so they've got about 80 years or so to be an independent nation this time on. By that time, they're in chaos. They're in chaos. And Rome comes in and just annexes them into the Roman Empire, gives them a tax, says, we'll take care of this problem for you. And Rome begins to rule. Turn to page 166. In the year 135. Now, what I've got here... let's go here. Ptolemy, that's the king of the south, invites Simon. This is kind of, we reviewed this last week. Simon invites Simon and his three sons, Mattathias, Judas, and John Hyrcanus. He's got Simon, this is one of the Maccabean boys. He's got three sons. He invites Ptolemy, the king of the south from Egypt, invites him to the royal palace in Jericho, which was like a summer palace, always nice there, hot in the summer. But there's an assassination plan. Simon is assassinated. Mattathias, his son, and Judas, his son, are assassinated. And only one escapes, and that's John Hyrcanus, kills the assassins. And now we've got John Hyrcanus is now your leader. He's now inherits his father's position of priest, general, governor. John Hyrcanus takes the office, and Antiochus the VII devastates Judea and attacks Jerusalem. So here's Syrians a chance to come down and take Judea and bring them back into their control. And so now Antiochus, which is, again, this is not Antiochus the Fourth or Antiochus Epiphanes. This is one of their descendants, the kings of the north. These are the Syrian Seleucid kings. John Hyrcanus drives the people unfit for war. So John Hyrcanus is now in charge of Jerusalem. He's got to have a confrontation with the king of the north. And so in Jerusalem, he realizes we can only take care of the people who can fight. So if you can't fight, if you can't defend yourself, if you can't contribute to society, get outside the walls. So he puts the weak people outside the walls, and anyone inside, they're not going to want to waste food, energy, effort, puts them outside, and they starve to death or are slaughtered. After a year, John Hyrcanus negotiates peace that agrees to give up their weapons and pay a tribute to, plus hostages and silver. So after a year of that, John Hyrcanus has to submit again to the Seleucids. That's who his his father and his uncles had fought against all those years. By 128, the Seleucids are in the midst of a struggle for the throne. And now, okay, so now you, between 135 and 128, Jerusalem again is under occupation or control of the Seleucids or the Syrians. By 128, the Syrians are having their own internal trouble. And so this is a good chance for John Hyrcanus to regain Judea's territory. He uses money from David's sepulcher to hire foreign troops to come in and assist him, hires mercenaries so he can help gain his control. He goes to Rome again to try to secure a peace treaty, but Rome is having their own internal trouble, and they've got a civil war brewing. So he's got a chance to rebel against the king of the north, the Syrians, the Seleucids. He got a chance to go to Rome for a treaty, but Rome can't help him, so he's alone there in Jerusalem. And in between 124 and 114, John Hyrcanus is not concerned with the Seleucid affairs in Syria. That's, again, John Hyrcanus. And three parties are developing in Jerusalem. Instead, you can see the storm is brewing in Jerusalem. And three parties are developing. The Pharisees, that's the pure ones, the separate ones. We call them the conservatives, the traditional ones. They're really the ones who were formed out of the Maccabean revolt, the ones who are going to hold to the traditional law. You've got the Sadducees. These are the ones who kind of lean. They're the priests. They're the ones who are buying and selling the priesthood from the northern king, from the Syrians. So they're willing to be Hellenized or secularized or become Greeks. They're wealthy. They've got the money. They've got the system is designed to bring the tithe into them. So they've got a built-in financial system. So you've got the conservatives, the Pharisees. You've got the priests, which are willing to become Hellenized and wealthy. And then you've got that third group, the Essenes, who see the chaos of the whole thing and say, we're just going to get out of this. And they leave and go out and live outside the city. That becomes the Qumran community where we get our Dead Sea Scrolls from. John the Baptist may have been part of that. A pretty good chance. At least he was baptizing just, you know, a few feet from Qumran. I mean, it's not a slam dunk. And some people, it's a good academic argument to get into. You become smarter because you get involved in it. But I would always begin the debate saying John the Baptist was an off-break from the Essenes, the Qumran community. But that's not a slam dunk. It's not biblical, that answer. Hyrcanus had supported the Pharisees, but when they asked him to lay down his priesthood and only serve as king, he leaves the Pharisees, and consequently the nation has drifted towards Hellenism. So John Hyrcanus was a Pharisee. But when the Pharisees say, you've got too much power, let's just do this right, he says, fine, I'll join the Sadducees. So he's a Republican. In the middle of the presidential debate, you know, Donald Trump, he says, you're not going to support me? I'll run with the Democrats, and takes on Hillary. Okay, kind of like that. I made that up. So anyway, now he's now running as a Democrat or a priest. Again, I'm sorry if I assigned it. I just use that as an illustration. No intention. I have a hard time figuring this out in history, let alone figuring out what's going on in the news today. So, okay, so anyway, he's now this group now, which the Maccabean revolt was a conservative, Pharisee-type movement. Now the leadership has just gone to the Sadducees. So you still got Pharisees, but they've lost their line of power. The power is with the priests. John Hyrcanus conquers Idumea. That's to the south. And this is going to be important because this is where Antipater and his son Herod are going to come from. They're going to be Idumeans. So John Hyrcanus conquers the Idumeans, which is the Edomites, and simply makes them Jewish. You just start following Jewish law. Just get, you know, go through the rituals and you're all Jewish. 105, John Hyrcanus dies. He was known as a prophet, a priest, and a king. Not necessarily biblically, but by position. Hyrcanus' wife is given power, and Hyrcanus' son, Judas Aristobulus, becomes the high priest. That's his name right here. His wife has the power, so her first son, Judas Aristobulus, is in that position. That lasts about a year. And then Judas Aristobulus loses power too. He dies. And Alexander Janneus, this is where we left off last week, Hyrcanus' second son, Alexander Janneus, becomes the high priest and king when Judas Aristobulus dies with no sons. And Alexander Janneus marries his wife. So now you've got this guy right here is the high priest. So just keep this in mind. This is the last of the Maccabees. This is his son. This is his grandson. This would be a grandson of one of the Maccabean brothers, and this is Alexander Janneus. Remember, Daniel says, you'll receive a little help, but when they succeed, many who are not sincere will join them. boom, this is it. This was the help, I believe, that, again, this is debatable. This was the help that Daniel prophesied would take place with the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes. But because they're successful, there's now it's becoming corrupt, and it's going to lead to disaster. 104, Hyrcanus the second son. Okay, the second bullet point in 104 B.C. The Jewish high priest, Alexander Janneus, conquers the Mediterranean coastal plain from Gaza, which is Philistine territory, Gaza Strip, up to Mount Carmel, which would be the Megiddo Valley, up west of Galilee. Under Alexander Janneus, the Hasmonean kingdom stretches from Dan to Beersheba. Old Testament references from Beersheba, which is south of in southern Judea, up to Dan, up which is on the Syrian border. In fact, even today, Dan is on the Syrian border. You can stand in Dan and look into Syria. 94. Alexander Janneus, so he's controlling. Alexander Janneus has got Israel, the map of Israel, Old Testament style, under his control. 94, Alexander Janneus takes the social and political conflict between the Pharisees and the Sadducees to the level of a civil war. At the Feast of Tabernacles, the high priest is to pour water, sacred water, on the altar according to the tradition of the Pharisees, but instead Alexander Janneus poured it on his own feet. As Janneus had hoped, members of the crowd who were holding palm branches and citrons, that's like a fruit, like a lemon and orange type of a fruit, became angry and began to throw their citron fruits at Janneus. So he's trying to cause a revolt. So instead of doing it the right way, he pours it on his own feet, knowing good and well that's going to irritate everybody. It's like, you know, at the presidential debate or whatever, first thing you do is you burn an American flag on stage. It's kind of like, you know, some people are going to support it, but there's going to be a good percentage that's going to start throwing stuff at you. And that's kind of what he's trying to, you know, get this thing stirred up. In response, now he's got a revolt there at the debate or at the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles. So they got to put down the revolt. How do you put down a revolt? Slaughter the people. He kills 6,000 Jews. This is not the Seleucids killing Jews or the Ptolemies, the Greeks killing Jews. These are the traditional Jews being killed by the more liberal Jews, the priestly group killing the Pharisaic group. 94 to 88, a six-year civil war follows that pitted a king Alexander Janneus and the Sadducees against the masses of the people and the Pharisees. So the masses are still with the Pharisees. 50,000 Jews are killed by each other in those 6 years in Jerusalem, in this land of Israel. We're not talking about the Antichrist. We're not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. We're not talking about Rome coming in. We're not talking about the King of the South coming up. We're talking about Jews killing Jews. And again, within 90 years, born is the Son of God into this mess. And it's like, and Herod killed the babies. What, weren't you paying attention to history? They're killing each other. I mean, it's like the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem. It's like, what a brutal man. It's like, just keep reading. That was just necessary. If there's a king down here, we're going to kill him before he gets into preschool. It's like, that's just common sense. Again, I don't support killing babies. I'm just saying, it's a terrible thing to mention on Christmas Eve at the Christmas story. But when you're reading history, it's like, Herod, what a wicked man. It's like, he's man of his times. I'm not supporting it. I'm just saying it's sometimes when you look at history, it seems like God could have maybe done a better job of prepping the world. In fact, I think he did a very good job of prepping the world. But, okay, I'm rambling. 88 B.C. Both sides are tired of fighting. Okay, good. Alexander Janneus asked the Pharisees, speaking as a Sadducee, he asked the Pharisees what he could do to stop the fighting. The Pharisees reply, kill yourself. The Pharisees then want the Syrian government for help. So this is when the Pharisees, these guys right here, the traditionalists, who fought the Syrian government with the Maccabean Revolt, they realize they've lost control of the Hasmonean family. So now the masses, the Pharisees, go up to the Syrians, the Seleucians, and say, will you help us fight the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees? In other words, the Maccabees who delivered the Jews from the Syrians. Now the Jews are going to the Syrians saying, will you deliver us from the Hasmoneans, the Maccabean family? When the Jews see, so here comes the Syrians. They come down from Damascus. That's the third bullet point in 88. Alexander Janneus is defeated, and he flees into the mountains, probably fleeing east into, like when Jesus says, flee to the mountains. He's going to go cross the Jordan into Jordan, which would be Moab, Ammon. When the Jews see a grandson of the Maccabees fleeing, they go, this isn't right. And so they start fighting. The Pharisees start fighting against the very people they invited to help them. And so now Alexander Janaeus recovers and returns to Jerusalem to do what? To avenge himself on the Pharisees who started this problem. And that's where we mentioned this last week too. Janaeus captures 800 Pharisees and crucifies them on crosses while he kills their family in front of them. I mean, what a mess. I mean, okay. 78, Alexander Janaeus dies. Thank God. Okay. His widow, Salome Alexandria, rules until 69. Alexander's widow gives the Pharisees permission to put to death the Sadducees that advised Alexander Janaeus. So now his widow says, yeah, we should probably kill some of those Sadducees who killed the Pharisees. They start killing them. The Sadducees, including her son, Aristobulus, approach her and ask for protection. So she gives the Pharisees permission to kill the Sadducees. But one of her sons, of course, is a Sadducee. So Aristobulus, that's his name, he says, can you give us some place, some kind of protection? So she gives him a fortress. So they go hide in the fortress. So Aristobulus and the Sadducees enter a fortress and wait for a chance to rebel. And that is in 78 AD, right there. That's with the queens right here, Alexandria, Queen Salome and Alexandria. So Aristobulus, that you're going to see his name right here. He's the one hiding in the fortress because the Pharisees are slaughtering him. 69 to 66 now. Now, just so you know, in the year 73, right there in between 78 and 69, Herod is born. Herod is now a little boy. Okay, he's a little boy doing whatever little Herods do. In 69 to 66, Salome Alexandria dies, leaving the throne and the priesthood to her weaker son, Hyrcanus. So she's got two sons, Hyrcanus the second, a Pharisee, and Aristobulus, the stronger son, who's hiding in a fortress because the Pharisees have got permission from the queen to kill the Sadducees. Aristobulus the Sadducee defeats Hyrcanus at Jericho. Hyrcanus the second flees to the fortress in Jerusalem. So this guy right here, who was in Jerusalem in control, he's now defeated and has to hide in the fortress in Jerusalem while Aristobulus the Pharisee comes in and he begins to rule. So one of the brothers is hiding in a fortress in Jerusalem while the other brother is ruling, and there are two different groups, Pharisees and Sadducees. You understand? This guy is supposed to be in charge, but he's been defeated in battle, so his brother moves back into the city. He hides in a fortress, locks himself up in a castle, basically, and hides there while Aristobulus begins to rule the city. And this is going to go back and forth now between Hyrcanus, the weaker brother, you may want to think of it that way, who's the Pharisee, and Aristobulus, who's the stronger, more aggressive brother, the Sadducee. Aristobulus right now is in charge. Hyrcanus is hiding. Just so you know, Hyrcanus is going to have several children, but one of them is going to be Mary Ann, which is going to be, eventually is going to be married to Herod. Herod is going to marry into this line. So Herod is going to marry Mary Ann. It's going to be his favorite wife. He's got several wives. He's going to kill her. But it's going to be his favorite wife. He's going to think she's revolting against him and her son, because any children he has with this Mary Ann are going to be Hasmoneans. And the people will always side with Herod's son, who's a descendant of the Hasmoneans through Mary Ann, through Hyrcanus, through Alexander, through John, through Simon, then Herod, who's an Idumean from the line of Esau, who's not even a Jew. So he no more than marries into the family, says, okay, now I've married into the family line. He has a wife who's a threat because she's an actual Hasmonean. And then he has a son through her. And it's like, oh my gosh, I just produced a child who's going to be more popular than me. And now remember, and he killed the babies in Bethlehem? He kills his wife and his own son because he thought they were a threat. And now he's going to go kill an unknown babies in Bethlehem? It's like, yeah, he's going to kill the babies in Bethlehem. So for the wise men to show, the wise men, if you know this, you're not real wise if you go tell Herod, where is he born king of the Jews? It's like, if you're wise, you're going to just go, stay low. You're wise enough to get there. You're wise enough to stay hidden, stay underground, and go find this guy and get out of the country before you announce who's been born king of the Jews. So the wise men are basically just giving Jesus or the babies of Bethlehem a death threat, a death wish. Anyway, you understand? So just so you know, Hyrcanus' daughter, Mary Ann, is going to marry Herod. And there's going to be a whole line. In fact, Caesar is going to say, in the Greek, and again, I don't know if I can say this correctly, quis and quis, two words. One is pig and what is son in the Greek. And Herod is, Caesar is eventually going to say, I think it's Octavian, Augustus Caesar, is eventually going to say, I would rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son. Why? He's trying to please the Jews. He won't kill a pig, but he'll slaughter his son. And again, this is what the Romans are saying about Herod, who was ruling for them in Jerusalem. It's like, I'd rather be his pig. I'd far be that I'd want to be his son. So anyway, that's all great stories yet to come. Nonetheless, right now we've got Hyrcanus locked up in Jerusalem in a fortress and Aristobulus the Sadducee ruling. And remember, their political parties have crucified each other at different times in the past in recent memory. Okay, so we go on to here. Aristobulus, the second bullet point in 69 to 66, Aristobulus defeats Hyrcanus at Jericho. Hyrcanus flees to a fortress in Jerusalem. Aristobulus allows Hyrcanus to keep his property and his life if Hyrcanus turns the throne and the priesthood over to Aristobulus. With the Sadducees regained their power, he forfeits his position, and the Sadducees now have power. With this peace treaty, the civil war that began in 124 B.C., with John Hyrcanus, seems to have come to an end. However, the Idumean governor, Antipater, does not want Aristobulus to rule. Now enters a brilliant man, Antipater. This is Herod's father. He's an Idumean. And he's been watching this, and as long as there's civil war going on up here, there's a chance he can work his way into the system. But now that Hyrcanus has forfeited Aristobulus, he's like, now there's no civil war. There's peace in the land. It's like, well, I need a war here to get my foot in the door. So now Antipater is going to end up supporting Hyrcanus and stirring this thing back up. And he's not really interested in this party or this party. He's interested in himself. So here goes Antipater now. Remember the name Antipater. That's Herod's father. He's the governor of Edom, or the governor of Idumea. Hyrcanus' peace in Jerusalem doesn't last, and he is forced to flee to Petra, to an Arabian king. Now, you know where Petra's at? That's way down south in Edom. That's southern Edom. Petra means the rock. It's, if you remember the couple of scenes in Indiana Jones, everybody talks about the reference. That's Indiana Jones riding through the cliffs of the rocks of Petra. Hyrcanus' peace doesn't last. The Idumean Antipater convinces the Aramean king to join him in attacking Aristobulus in Jerusalem and restoring Hyrcanus. So now, Antipater and the Arabian king from Petra join forces to march on Jerusalem to support Hyrcanus and overthrow Aristobulus. So you're getting foreign interest in here, obviously. Okay, in 65 B.C., enter Pompey, the Roman general, who is conquering Asia Minor. Here's Pompey. Here comes your Roman generals right down here. He leads you right up to Julius Caesar. Pompey is fighting up in Asia Minor and sends one of his generals, Scaurus, that's the next game right here, sends a general down to check on things in Damascus, and basically is ending the Seleucid Empire. So the Seleucid Empire is collapsing at this time, and Rome is moving into Syria. Aristobulus and his brother Hyrcanus both appear before the Roman general Scaurus. So when Scaurus, the general under Pompey, arrives in Damascus, both these brothers go off like they have been trained to do. Can you help me get my position back? Will you appoint me as high priest? I'll give you money. It's like, what is going on here? Well, we usually buy the high priesthood from the Gentiles who have the most power. So we'll. It's like, okay. So it ends up, here's how it plays out. They're hoping to be appointed high priest. Aristobulus is appointed. So the stronger brother, the Sadducee, is appointed. Consequently, Antipater and the Arameans are forced to leave Jerusalem. So watch this if you even are interested. The Idumean Antipater and the Arabian king are supporting Hyrcanus in a war in Jerusalem. Both these boys go up to the Roman general and say, will you support us and make me the high priest? They choose Aristobulus. So now you've got the Roman Empire and Aristobulus the Sadducee on the same side who are fighting against Hyrcanus and Antipater of Idumea and the Arabian kings. You understand? And that's when Antipater goes, oh, okay. And he backs off, leaving Hyrcanus by himself, says, I can't fight the Romans. Okay, we turn the page. In 64, Syria becomes a Roman province, and a hurricane wipes out the Judean crops. 63 B.C., notice this is titled on the top of this page, page 168, this is titled the Roman Empire. So if you're following Daniel's prophecy, this is the rising of that other beast. Now, this is that beast that's maybe going to continue. If you read the new book, this is going to become the Roman Empire. It's going to break into the Christian Empire, the Constantine. What am I thinking of? The Byzantine Empire, which then is going to be broken off into the Ottoman Empire, which ends in World War I. So again, that's the Roman Empire begins here. It never really ended. It just became Christian and then became Muslim and was finally put to rest in 1918, 1921. Again, that's all interesting stuff, debatable. We got to quit. Page 63. Pompey arrives in Damascus in 65 B.C. Aristobulus and Hyrcanus will appear. We already read all this before. Before deciding, Pompey goes on a campaign against the Nabataeans. Aristobulus' help. Pompey is going to arrive at the walls of Jerusalem. Hyrcanus' party is at war with Aristobulus. So when Pompey ends up in Jerusalem, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, the two parties, the Pharisees and Sadducees, are fighting. And that is where Pompey, the Roman leader, is going to arrive in Jerusalem. This is his first picture of Jerusalem. It's a civil war of Jews slaughtering Jews inside the city. So that's where he arrives. Hyrcanus' party opens the western gate, which would be what we'd call the Joppa Gate, for Pompey to enter, but Aristobulus' party flees to the temple fortress. So the temple is used as a fortress. There, it's got a wall around it, so it's a place of protection. But the priests continue to do their sacrifice. As this war is going on, a civil war is breaking out, the priests are going to be faithful to the covenant, and they keep offering sacrifices. It says there's going to be 12,000 Jews die. Pompey finally breaks through the Temple Mount, into the Temple Mount. Pompey then enters the Holy of Holies. He's in the Temple Mount. He goes through the holy place, past the lampstand and the table of showbread, past the altar of incense, pulls back the curtain to enter the holy place, expecting to see, you know, something pretty cool and holy, because this is what they're all fighting about. And when he gets there, there's nothing there, because the Ark of the Covenant's not there. And so he's like, what is this? He's a Gentile, we're used to idols, and there's nothing here. So anyway, it says here, he enters the Holy of Holies just to take a look and is surprised that it is empty and holds no image of the Jewish God. The temple is cleansed after he leaves and sacrifices resume. So Pompey, expecting to see something big, goes in and it's like a golden room with nothing in it. It's like, okay, whatever. And he leaves, not understanding what was going on. Pompey makes the land of Judah a province of Rome, and that's important, in 63 B.C. Judah, now that had gained its independence, is now part of the Roman Empire. It's going to remain under control of others until it gains its independence in 1948, as you know that story. Pompey travels back to Rome. He takes Aristobulus. Now this is interesting. He takes Aristobulus with him, and his family is prisoners. Aristobulus and his two daughters and his younger son are marched in front of Pompey, kind of part of the triumphal procession back into Rome. Many other Jews are forced to march in the procession to Rome. Aristobulus' older son, Alexander, escapes. The story continues. So Aristobulus is taken in a triumphal procession with his family back to Rome by Pompey. Hyrcanus is left in Jerusalem, but Alexander has escaped. And we can continue to figure out that's a great grandson or how that all plays together. You're kind of following that at all? I mean, a little bit? Okay. 57. Now, let's just say this. In 61, Pompey has victory in Rome. He conquers Rome. And the first triumvirate is, now this is Roman history, is formed. The first triumvirate is Pompey, Caesar, and then Crassus. And the Crassus' name is right here. They were the three unified, like the triumvirate. They were the three rulers of Rome at that time. In 57, Alexander, Aristobulus' son, drives out Hyrcanus, of course. He returns to Jerusalem and takes possession of the Jerusalem fortress. So Alexander, Aristobulus' son, returns, drives Hyrcanus out and takes control of the fortress. 56, Aristobulus escapes the Roman prison and leads the Sadducees in revolt in Jerusalem. Somehow Aristobulus escapes, and he's now back in Jerusalem with his son. I mean, you think the Roman Empire could do better of handling of their prisoners. But anyway, you want to be set them free on purpose. The Roman consul of Syria, Gabinius, attacks Jerusalem and restores Hyrcanus. So now you got this guy right here, Gabinius. He now comes back, fights for Hyrcanus, and puts Hyrcanus back in position. So now the Romans are in full-fledged choosing sides on who's going to win what part of the Jewish Empire. 55, Antipater helps Gabanias defeat Alexander. Now, Antipater has a chance now to side with Rome. Remember, he got driven. He left early because he's not going to fight Rome. Well, now Herod's father, Antipater, sees a chance. Rome is now siding with Hyrcanus, which is who Antipater originally was siding with. So now he comes up and he supports the general, Roman gut general. So now you got Antipater fighting with the Romans, which is only going to mean good things for Antipater and his family because Rome is going to succeed. So now that puts him on the winning side. 54. Crassus, one of the first triumphant of Julius Caesar, Pompey and Crassus, replaces Gabanias as the proconsul of Syria. So now Crassus is down in Syria. Crassus robs the temple in Jerusalem of 2,000 talents of gold and 8,000 talents worth of objects to pay for his war with the Parthians. Crassus dies when the Parthian king captures him and then pours liquid gold down his throat and then decapitates him. That's Pompey, Crassus, and Julius Caesar the triumphant. Crassus now is eliminated because you just heard the story. Cassius replaces Crassus. Cassius replaces Crassus. So now you've got Pompey, Cassius, and Julius Caesar are the triumphant ruling Rome right now. And again, notice how they're working around Jerusalem. Jerusalem is right there, a hot spot. They're coming and going in Jerusalem. Civil war breaks out now between Julius Caesar and Pompey. Pompey and Julius Caesar, civil war breaks out, and you know this story. Pompey is defeated and flees to Egypt. For 47, in 49, Julius Caesar is named dictator for life. That's when Rome had a dictator. Julius Caesar is the last surviving member of the triumphant, and so they just say, you're a dictator for life. You're now our basic king, but they didn't call him king. So that's Julius Caesar. 47, Antipater the Idumean assists Julius Caesar against Pompey. Again, choosing the winning horse puts Antipater in a good position. So now Antipater is going to have favors coming from Julius Caesar, which he's going to use. After Julius Caesar defeats Pompey, Antipater and Hyrcanus are rewarded in Syria by Caesar. So now Hyrcanus, the Hasmonean, Antipater, the governor of Idumea, the father of Herod, are rewarded by Julius Caesar, the last surviving member of the triumphant of Rome. So now everybody's happy. The Idumeans, Hyrcanus, the Jew, and Julius Caesar, everything's going to work out perfectly. Okay. Caesar makes Hyrcanus the governor of the Jews. Caesar makes Antipater the procurator and manager of Caesar's affairs in Judea. Do you see this right here? Caesar makes Antipater the procurator or manager of Caesar's affairs in Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. Caesar tells Antipater, Hyrcanus the Hasmonean, he's the governor of Judea. Leave him alone. But I want you, Antipater, the Idumean, because you're faithful to me, to oversee the whole land, Galilee. You see where the story's going, right? So now Herod's father's in charge of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee, which is basically the map of Israel. Who's in charge of it? Antipater. Could he have played that better? I mean, you understand, that's a politician. Okay. Now, who's watching Antipater role here? Little Herod. I don't know if they call him Harry or what. But little Herod's watching his dad work the Roman Empire and manipulate his way into, not just into Jerusalem, but he's in charge of, Antipater's in charge of the land, which includes the part that Hyrcanus is in charge of. I mean, this guy's got some power. Okay, we're not done. We may be done when the clock gets there, but I'm not done here. Caesar and Antipater become friends. Yes. And live happily ever after. And the Jews are given special privileges because of Antipater. So Caesar treats the Jews well because of his relationship with Antipater, who's in charge of the land. Antipater rebuilds Jerusalem's walls. They always build Jerusalem's walls when you're serious. Caesar reinstates Cleopatra down in Egypt. Now, again, that's another whole story. Antipater becomes a Roman citizen. So now, Antipater is a Roman citizen. 46 B.C., the Jews approach Caesar and ask for a new deal. Okay, we don't like this deal. Caesar gives them the following. An annual payment of tribute was to be made according to their religious law. Okay, you can pay us based on your religious principles. The high priest was to receive the customary revenues from the people, meaning the regular tithes and offerings. They were to incur no military burden. You don't have to send your Jews to fight in the Roman military. Joppa was to be given to the high priest and Lydia to be restored. Hyrcanus was to receive seats of honor for himself and his friends at the gladiator shows and the Super Bowl in Rome, which, America's Got Talent. And Hyrcanus was to have special privileges in approaching the Senate. In other words, if you want to get an appeal, you get special. Okay, great. So they sign on. There's your new deal. All these privileges come because Antipater's diplomatic skills, but the Jews still hate Antipater. Why? Well, he's not a Jew. He's an Edomite. You now have the family of Jacob being ruled by a descendant of Esau. Do you understand what I just said right there? Esau is now in charge and getting favor from Rome for Jacob's children. And they know history, and they don't like that. We don't care if you give us the world. We don't like you. You're Edom. You're Esau. Antipater then appoints his two sons. Antipater, now you don't want to miss this one. Antipater then appoints his two sons to positions of governor under him over his area of Galilee, Judea, and Samaria. Phasael, Antipater's oldest son, Herod's older brother, becomes the governor of Jerusalem. And Herod, just for some practice and for some training, is made governor of Galilee. Just kind of up there around there, not much going on there, but he's given chance. But this is all Herod needs. He just needs a spot on the team. Just let me play, coach. Put me in right field and I'll show you what I can do. So he's in right field. He gets the bat at the plate. He's batting ninth. He's playing right field, but he's got a place on the team. And Herod's going to use it. 45 B.C. Herod, at the age of 25, takes... Now, again, Galilee at this time, we haven't talked about it at all, but it's wild. It's on that border of Syria and Judea. It's no man's land. It's a place where the rebels from Syria come in and the rebels from Judea go up. The rebels from across, it's that trade route that runs right through it or right below it through that valley, Megiddo Valley. I mean, that trade route runs right there. So Galilee is a place for bandits, a place for thieves, for rebels to hide out. And Herod's in charge of this. 25-year-old kid. He's like a little Alexander the Great, basically. Again, we don't like Herod. Herod's not a good man. But Herod was a brilliant politician. He was a gutsy warrior, and he's a great builder. We can still go see the remains of the buildings he built. He was a survivor. Herod was, no matter what you think of him as an individual, you may not have voted for him, but you definitely wanted to study him and follow any kind of advice you can get as far as worldly advice from Herod. Now, is Herod in hell today? If you think he's in hell today or wherever people go, Herod is not in the presence of the Lord, I don't think. Who knows? But you wouldn't want him for spiritual advice. But if you're Hillary, you'd want him on some kind of advisory capacity. Or Donald Trump or Ron Paul or George Bush or George Washington or whatever. Okay. But anyway, he's 25. Well, you decide. You decide. If you really are a reader and you want to read something interesting, go find a biography about Herod and just read about Herod. You will admire Herod. You may not like him, but you wouldn't want to go to war with him. Anyway. Herod, at the age of 25, takes the wild, dangerous land of Galilee that is filled with criminals and subdues it. Herod immediately captures and kills Ezekias, a leader of the gangsters. Rome and Syria approve of Herod's actions, but Hyrcanus and the Jewish leaders become jealous and accuse Herod of breaking Jewish law. Okay, that's the only thing they can go with, is he's breaking Jewish law. I'm not sure if I've got it in the story here or not, but one of the things he does... Now, we went to... We were there in 2007. I'm not sure. We didn't go up on top of the caves of Arbela, up on that top up there on the northwest side of Galilee. There's a steep place. When you get on Galilee, you look to the northwest. There's a peak up there. And there's caves on the sides that comes down. There's caves. And bandits would hide in these caves. And they could raid the caravans and then run and hide in these caves. And no one could get them. They'd raid. They control the land. And one of the stories about Herod is, how do we stop? I've got to get control of this land. So what he did, he designed cages that would go up on top of Arbela. And you can look at my website. You can see pictures of Arbela. And you can see the caves in the wall there. But anyway, he put in cages and would lower the people down, his soldiers in these cages that were protected, and they had some kind of tar and gas and fire, and would just burn, just torch the caves and burn the gangsters, the criminals, the thieves, and just went down the side, just torched the whole place, and just scattered them. I mean, just destroyed them. And we know what to do with them. Here it says, well, I know what to do with them. I'll kill them. I'll just burn them. And just torch them. And of course, the Jews are like, you can't tear. Those are Jewish people. Those are Jewish citizens. They're rebels. They're causing trouble. They're destroying my government. I'm going to destroy. Now, again, that's a fun conversation right there. You can make that very political right now if you wanted to. But Herod solved the problem. And the Jews say, this isn't right. You're not doing it the right way. Herod then is ordered to appear before the Roman proconsul, Sextus Caesar, in Damascus. So now he's got to appear before Rome, and the Jews are going to be there accusing Herod, this 25, 28-year-old kid now. And he's just got done, he just solved the crime problem. The crime rate, the illegal aliens, everything has gone away. He solved the problem. But it's like, you didn't follow the law. Of course I didn't. You can't follow the law and fight criminals. You've got to kill them. Okay, I'm preaching now. Not necessarily right, really. I'm just saying what Herod is saying. And now he comes into this, here's the Roman consul, the Roman court. The Jews are there to accuse him. And here comes Herod. And Herod's not, well, here's, watch it. Herod, it says, when Herod walks into the court, he stuns his Jewish accusers with his appearance, being dressed like a king in all purple and escorted by a bodyguard. The Jews were completely, here this guy walks in. It's like, who is that? That looks like a king. It looks like a Persian king. Or it's like, who is it? That's Herod. That's the guy you're accusing. He comes dressed, looks like a king with a bodyguard of, bodyguard, secret service. And they walk in there, and the Jews are like, completely intimidated. And the Romans are like, yeah, that's the way we like it when you roll. They like it. They go, that's cool. That was real cool. The Jews are intimidated. The Romans are impressed. And and Sextus Caesar loves it. And the proconsul gives orders to release Herod. He says, Herod, you can go. You're free to go. Any other questions? In other words, Herod just plays the game right, impresses the Romans, intimidates the Jews. Was he right or wrong? That wasn't the issue. What was the issue was, that was impressive, Herod. Okay, if you like it or not, that's Herod. 44, Julius Caesar is assassinated. Okay, now things are going to change. Because that Julius Caesar is the one who's supporting Antipater, who put his son Herod as governor of Galilee. And now Herod is now on the playing field. He's intimidated some people. He's impressed some people. Herod has solved some problems. He's a game changer. But Julius Caesar's dead. He was stabbed 23 times, as you know the story, by his Senate. Everybody stabbed him once so that no one could blame anybody, just like the guy had too much power. Cassius and Brutus flee after killing Caesar. These are two guys. They tax Antipater's land. They need money. Herod raises the tax money first, and Cassius promises to make him king of Judea after the war. So Cassius and Brutus flee after killing Caesar. They come over to Antipater's land, and Herod's got to raise his part of the money from Galilee. And that says, okay, but I want something. I'll get the money out of the people, but I better have a promise. Okay, you'll be king. Cassius promises to make him king of Judea after the war. So now Herod's playing for what position? King of the Jews, if he gets the money, and supports Cassius and Brutus in the war. Okay, and they fight against Octavian and Antony. I jumped down to 43 BC. Antipater is poisoned. Herod's dad is killed. Herod kills the assassin, which name is Malichus. Cassius and Brutus fight Octavius and Antony. Remember Octavian and Antony. Octavius is Julius Caesar's adopted son. Octavius is going to become the winner of this battle because the battle between Cassius and Brutus and Octavian and Antony is going to end up being a victory for Octavius and Antony, which is going to pit then Octavius against Antony for winner takes all. Octavius is your Caesar Augustus. In the days of Caesar Augustus, that is Octavius. That's after his name was changed by the Roman Senate. Hyrcanus revolts in Jerusalem, but Herod puts it down. Antony and Octavius defeat Cassius and Brutus in that civil war. Antony appoints his friend Herod as ruler of Judea. So now Antony is a winner, and Antony is going to have a relationship with Cleopatra in Egypt. But he appoints his friend Herod as a ruler in Judea. So now you've got Antony and Cleopatra, Antony supporting Herod in his position, But now Antony's at war with Octavian, who you know is going to win because he's going to become Caesar Augustus. And now Herod is, right ahead of time, you know, is betting on the wrong team. Herod is in position. Remember the tower on Fort Antonia? You know, on the Temple Mound? Fort Antonia, where Pilate and those guys are at? That's named, that was built by Herod in honor of his friend Antony. Fort Antonia is Antony. He didn't build any buildings for Cleopatra. He hated Cleopatra. He saw her as manipulative. He didn't like manipulation. He liked to manipulate. He didn't like to be manipulated. Okay. 42. Herod marries the granddaughter of Hyrcanus II, Mary Ann. Since he's in charge of Judea, I'll marry into the Hasmonean line. It's a brilliant idea. You married right into the royal line. Who can argue with that? Until you have a child, have a son, like you said before. The royal prince from the line of the Maccabees. This places Herod and his descendants in the royal line of the Hasmoneans. Antony and Octavian split and start another civil war in 32. Herod supports his friend Antony. In fact, he's built a tower for him, a fortress in Jerusalem. 31. Antony is defeated by Octavian and flees to Egypt. That's the story of Cleopatra and him dying. So now Octavian is the winner. In 30 AD, Octavian defeats Antony and Cleopatra. And that is her full name, Cleopatra the Seventh. So when you talk about Cleopatra, see, she was the seventh of the Cleopatras, Philopater. So, I mean, and she's Greek, okay? All these Cleopatras are Greeks. They're not Egyptian goddesses. They're Greek women, if that's whatever that means. Antony and Cleopatra both die. You know the story. She thinks Antony's dead, and he commits suicide, and Antony's not dead. He comes, and she dies in his arms. At least that's the way the story goes. Herod is ordered to appear before Caesar Augustus. So now everything has gone so well for Herod, except his dad's dead. But Herod was the governor. He was on the fast track to be king. All they had to do was win the war, and he's going to be the king of Judea. Now his friend that he supported, Antony, is dead. And there's no one now in Rome supporting Herod. And that's where Herod and Antipater got all their power, was from Rome. And now the winner, Octavian, who's going to become Caesar Augustus, tells Herod, we need to talk. So he's going to bring Herod in, the leader of Judea. He's going to bring Herod in and basically, you know, put him in prison for life, cut his head off, dismiss him, abolish him, you know, whatever. It's over for Herod. Here we are. Herod is ordered to appear before Caesar Augustus, Octavian. By this time, when he appears, Octavian's name has been changed from Octavian, the adopted son of Julius Caesar, to the exalted one, Augustus, Caesar Augustus. Caesar, the August, I don't want to say enlightened one, but he is, what's the word, way of saying it? He's outstanding. He's the illuminated one. Okay, Herod explains that he is loyal. Basically, he says, Octavian basically says, what should I do with you? I don't know the whole conversation. You can read more about it somewhere. But basically, Herod says, listen, he says, you do whatever you want to. And again, Herod being very bold, very confident, willing to play. He says, you do what you want to, but I tell you what, he says, I'm loyal to my friends. And you saw how I was faithful to Antony even in the final days. He says, I was faithful to my friends. I'm always faithful to my friends. And right now, he says, I think Caesar needs a friend. And I'll be faithful to you. And Caesar Augustus is like, So he says, I will be your friend. Just like I was Antony's friend, I was Julius Caesar's friend, I'll be your friend back in Jerusalem. And again, governments are being shifted around, coming together. He gets the appointment. He doesn't get disciplined. He gets the reappointment now from the enemy, puts him in position, the guy he fought against. But again, Rome puts him back in position. Herod explains that he is loyal to his friends and that now Caesar Augustus can take advantage of Herod being his friend. Caesar Augustus agrees that the need for loyal friends is like that, and sends Herod back to Judea to continue as king of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. So now you've got Herod, the king of Judea, that's Jerusalem area, Samaria, that's that northern land north, up butting up against Galilee, and Galilee. In other words, Herod now is king of the land of Israel. And Idumean is king over all of this. that was conquered by the Hasmonean revolt. Now you've got an Idumean supported by Rome, king of the Jews. Why? How did he become king of the Jews? The Romans made him king of the Jews because he was a great political player. He was brilliant. We've got some little things there, and I think, my goodness, I ran out of material. Hey, if you've ever been excited, you should be excited. And on this page right here, you've got just a little chart there breaking down Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the beginning of the age of the Gentiles when Jerusalem was under occupation of the different empires. The three captives of Jerusalem coming back from Babylon, we've talked about that obviously, but it kind of clarifies it. The three returns. Rome's slow rise and slow decline. Now on this you can see I've got it written out, and I have them declining in 1453 when the last Roman emperor was killed by Muhammad the II in the Battle of Constantinople, when Constantinople fell. And that's when the Byzantine Empire, which was the Roman Empire, became the Ottoman Empire. And it really was a matter of just a switch of leadership. And again, you can say the Roman Empire ended in 1453, and I do here. But then in this last book, I make the suggestion that maybe that empire continued into the Ottoman Empire, which is interesting and opens up some other options. Again, who knows how it all comes together, but that's that place right there. So we pick this up now. Next week, we pick up the life of Christ. And because in the days of Herod, the king of the Jews, was born Jesus Christ, and Caesar Augustus issued a decree that everyone should be taxed or a census to be taken. Why? Because he's building his empire, building his government. He needs to find out where the money's going to come from. And Herod's going to follow that up. They're going to count the people to get the taxation to keep the Roman Empire up and running. Caesar Augustus, again, you can make your own decisions, but was one of the great leaders, I think, of the ancient world of the Roman Empire. Caesar Augustus set things in motion, public policy, infrastructure, did a great job of managing. Now, were these guys Christians, believers, followers of God? Not necessarily. But they did know how to function in the reality that our God created, if you understand what I'm saying. I mean, you've got biblical truth, but you also have the reality of the way the world works. And Nebuchadnezzar was great. Cyrus was great. Alexander the Great was great. Herod was great at this. Julius Caesar, Octavian, Caesar got. They knew how the system worked. Now, again, that's just an interesting idea. It's like, so whatever it's worth. I'll pray, and I'd love to ask if there's any questions. But I was watching someone says there's five things, mistakes that speakers make. And that is to make their presentation, then say to the crowd, are there any questions? Because that's a terrible way to end the class. I realize how many times I talk for an hour and say, are there any questions? And if a good professional speaker would not do that. So, consider me a good professional speaker. I'm going to pray and walk out. Okay. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into these things, to give us a perspective of the Gospels and of the New Testament. We do know that you're the Lord of history, that you control things, and even in our own day, things are being brought together just as you purpose them. And Father, we ask that we would stay true to your word, stay true to what you've called us to do, and that we would be the shining light that would lead many into righteousness in our own time. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for being here and spending time.